there was a civilization, much like ours, but with a greater intelligence, greater powers, and a greater capacity for good.
Even though you've been raised as a human being, you are not one of them.
Well, good evening, folks. Welcome back to the Light of Day radio show, coming to you live from the Sonora Desert in Tucson, Arizona. This is your host, Sheldon Day. Welcome to the Sheldon Day radio program, The Light of Day. I'm hearing myself echo back. There's a technical problem here. I don't know if anybody on the network's on the air, but I'm hearing myself echo back. Jimmy or Sean, if you're out there on the network, can you send me a message here on the Skype and let me know why I'm hearing myself echoing back? It's pretty bad. What I'm doing is talking, and then about 10 seconds later, I completely hear what I just said. I'm not sure what's happening here, but just bear with us, folks. I'm going to disconnect, folks. Just hang on here. I'm going to reconnect to the Skype and see if that clarifies the problem. Okay, I've reconnected with the Skype. Hopefully this will rectify the problem. I'm going to give it a few seconds here to see if I start hearing myself echo back. Okay, well, I guess everything's okay now. No, it's not. Jimmy or Sean, if you're out there listening to my show, can you send me a Skype message and let me know what's going on, why I would be echoing? I can't do my show this way because I'm hearing everything I'm saying repeating. Yeah, I'm still on air here, folks. Just bear with me. I'm trying to figure out why this is going on, but very annoying echo is occurring over with the Skype. Folks, I'm going to have to disconnect two programs here and reconnect. So if you just want to go get a cup of coffee or something and come back in a minute here, just bear with us, folks. Sorry for this. Okay, I'm trying this out again. I'm going to have to see if I got the problem resolved or not. I disconnected everything and reconnected. I'll find out here in a few seconds if there's going to be any echoing going on. But I can't do my show that way. I know it's very annoying. You know, let's just figure I had a really good show lined up for tonight. I had got a lot of preparation done here for it, and sure enough, this has got to happen. Well, apparently it's working okay now. I'm not hearing any more echoing going on. Anyway, welcome to Light of Day on Saturday, March 3rd, 2010. This is officially show number 2. I wanted to go over this this NASA discovery that I came upon again, even though I've mentioned it already on my show last week, but the archive did not allow capture of that announcement, so I'd like to reiterate it again because this is such an important discovery I've stumbled upon. Well, apparently everything's fixed because I'm not hearing myself echo anymore. I don't know what was going on, but I'm really glad that's taken care of. Anyway, on to the FOIA request. I'm just looking for one page here and pretty much be ready to go. Just bear with me, folks. Still looking for it. Oh, here it is. Okay. All right, this is dated August 31st, 2007, by the official NASA website. Contract release C is in Charlie 07-44. NASA awards contract to an outside vendor, specifically a subsidiary of Prudential for employee relocation services. This is a rather blank statement. It's only about three paragraphs here. So here it is. Bay St. Louis, Mississippi. On Friday, NASA announced the selection of Prudential Relocation of Washington to provide employee relocation services to NASA. The estimated value of this contract is $74 million. Now, folks, that's three times more than the entire domestic division of the CIA was allocated to relocate their own people, their entire domestic division out to Denver. This firm fixed price performance-based blanket purchase agreement with delivery and task orders is for a 2-year period with 3 1-year option periods. So if they decide to extend this contract, folks, that would go until, let's see, up until September of this year. So NASA is obviously very aware that something's about to happen. Like I said, I got to thinking after finding out about John Moore's information that at some point NASA's going to have to start moving their own people because the Kennedy Space Center is practically right on the Atlantic Ocean. And sure enough, here's the third paragraph in this news release. Prudential Relocation will provide employee relocation services, including guaranteed home sales and movement of household goods. The contractor also will provide home marketing assistance, counseling, destination area services, and property management for NASA employees who are relocating. All services are available to all NASA centers and associated facilities. For information about the NASA Shared Services Center, visit www.nssc.nasa.gov. So I decided to embark on my own journey here and trying to figure out more about this. John Moore, he's a talk show host over on RBN, he suggested I do a FOIA request, and this is the first FOIA request I've ever done in my life. I sent out my first request to NASA down in Mississippi on January 26th. Then I resent that same request on the next day, January 27th. I got my first reply back from NASA on February 2nd. The second reply was February 16th. And then I actually called NASA the next day on Wednesday, February 17th. And then I got my third reply on Tuesday, March 2nd. And the fourth reply, which was the last reply, folks, that I have gotten from NASA, was on Wednesday, March 3rd, the following day. On that fourth and last reply NASA sent to me, they requested additional time to review the contract for release. This contract, by the way, has undergone 55 modifications since its inception. So, sometime this week, I'm probably going to resend a request out to NASA to find out what's going on with this, because me and John Moore are eager to learn more about it. I also got this thing about the Svalbard Global Doomsday Seed Vault up in Norway. I actually printed this out just for my show here tonight. By the way, folks, I'm not going to take any calls tonight because I got too much to cover, especially with my beginning of my show being interrupted. So next week, I plan on carrying John DiNardo. I have to get in touch with him, but he's a Planet X researcher, and I do plan on carrying him as my guest next week. So possibly during the fourth show, I'll start taking callers from the audience. Now, if any of you folks want some excellent, outstanding information about this Doomsday Seed Vault up in Norway, it only took them 8 months, by the way, to build this seed vault. So, you know, if they were going to need it 20, 30, 40, 50 years into the future, they wouldn't have been in such a hurry to build this thing. It only took them 8 months. But if you want to visit an outstanding website about this seed vault, go to futureforall.org. That's futureforall.org. There's just some excellent information in here. The construction cost, folks, for the seed vault was approximately $9 million. The cost was funded entirely by the Kingdom of Norway. I'm just looking over here. There are currently over 300,000 samples of seeds stored in the vault, totaling over 150 million seeds, but that was just updated here a few weeks ago. I think they hit a 500,000 or... Yeah, I can't remember now what the total was, but... The seed vault has the capacity to store 4.5 million seed samples, more than the total number of varieties in existence. Each sample contains an average count of 500 seeds, so a maximum of 2.25 billion seeds could be stored in the facility. The seeds are stored at minus 4/10 of a degree Fahrenheit below zero. The seeds are sealed in specially designed four-ply foil packages, placed in sealed boxes, and stored on shelves inside the vault. Anyway, there's a lot to this. It's just a 10-page printout I got here, but I also want to encourage folks that to go watch a segment that the weekly TV show CBS's 60 Minutes did on the vault. That's readily available on the internet to watch that. Now back to the NASA contract. By the way, folks, there's Spaceport America down in near Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, and I got to thinking if, you know, the last shuttle flight is September of this year, if they, maybe they're going to continue manned human space flight out of that facility, because it is partially underground and highly above sea level. And the key there is, one of the keys there is being above highly above sea level, because the U.S. Navy says you have to be at least 400 feet above sea level to survive these impending earth changes that are about to happen. Now, whether the Navy, the U.S. Navy carries out these earth changes, or if it's a Planet X type object, or a combination of both, we may never really know. But it's something to be definitely open to, because we just, you know, we may never be able to prove it, but it's sort of nice to know what's going on. Now, I got to thinking, if the elite are going to these underground shelters, which they call hotels, why would they be doing that if they're going to die underground because of these cataclysmic seismic events that are supposed to happen? And I remember something John Lear said. He's been on a few alternative radio shows mentioning this, but he says out near Hawthorne, or in Hawthorne, Nevada, that there's an underwater U.S. Navy submarine base. Now I got to thinking also, connecting some dots here, that I personally believe there's a hollow earth, and maybe the U.S. Navy, if they're the ones that are going to be pulling off these earth changes, maybe the elite will be going to places like this inside the inner earth if the seismic events become too cataclysmic. This is something. There's an underwater U.S. Navy submarine base out in the middle of the desert in Nevada. John Lear claims that this connects to a I can't remember, some facility on the West Coast in California. John Lear also talks about these orbiting weapons platforms, and he believes that the space shuttle missions have been putting up these orbiting weapons platforms over all these years, and I kind of got to thinking about that. maybe they're going to use these weapon platforms up in orbit to fire at these incoming rocks that are going to be headed this way. Because according to John Moore's classified source, whoever that is, he says that Planet X has a debris field of rocks, big rocks and small rocks, a quarter of a million miles wide on either side of it. Now, there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there on this issue of Planet X. I would encourage folks to go listen to Professor Jim McCanney's shows. He did a 10-part series on the many misconceptions of Planet X back in the starting in the fall of last year. I don't have the exact dates here, but I'll eventually be finding that out so I can convey that to you all. Now, there's an update here with the John Moore information. He's ready to acquire two or three FEMA books that talk about the continental United States being massively flooded, and he's going to post these on his website here, hopefully within the week. And I got to thinking about that because, well, folks, we're only about a minute or so here from break, but I'm going to finish this up what I'm saying. You know, John Moore is ready to release these FEMA documents on his website, and the FEMA administrators had a conference up in Washington, D.C., I believe it was back on March 12th. You can go to the FEMA website to look that up. But they met with emergency management center directors from predominantly metropolitan areas on the coastlines. So only God knows what was really discussed there. But, you know, most of the emergency management center directors were from major cities on the coastlines, with the exception of Denver and Chicago also being in attendance, but maybe there's something to that. Anyway, we're coming up on our break already. It's a shame what had to happen during the start of the show here, but when we come back, I'm going to be reading something that a researcher down in Texas by the name of Greg Erickson sent out. An open letter to the New World Order.
Free speech guaranteed. You're listening to the Orion Talk Radio Network. This is Micro 1650 AM, a 100 milliwatt Part 15 broadcaster. No matter what your political ideology, it should be clear that the mainstream media simply doesn't give you the whole story. These days, if you want the truth, you have to know where to find it. Well, you found it right here on Micro 1650 AM. We've partnered with some of the best alternative news sources in the business. RBN, the IRN USA Network, Oracle Broadcasting, Liberty News Radio, Accent Radio, and The Micro Effect. These networks offer intelligent, informative, and thought-provoking programming that will open your eyes to what's really going on. Your comments and questions about the programming are always welcome. Contact us at micro1650am@gmail.com. That's micro1650am@gmail.com. You can listen online and find out more about us at micro1650am.com. Enjoy the show.
I couldn't help at one point in our discussions privately with General Secretary Gorbachev. When you stop to think that we're all God's children, wherever we may live in the world, I couldn't help but say to him, just think how easy his task and mine might be in these meetings that we held if suddenly there were this world from some other species, from another planet, outside in the universe. We'd forget all the little local differences that we have between our countries, and we would find out once and for all that we really are all human beings here on this earth together.
Well, hello, folks. Welcome back to the Light of Day with your host, Sheldon Day, coming to you live from the Sonora Desert in Tucson, Arizona. I decided to play that little sound bite there as just a reminder as to what former President Ronald Reagan said back in the mid to late 80s, talking about some type of external threat from space. Maybe this has to do with the incoming cosmic event that the elite and human race are about to witness. I don't know. Just food for thought, and I just wanted to play my MP3 player plugged into my mixer board to see how that comes across. Checking the input volume levels and all that. Anyway, to this letter now in the New World Order Denver Airport, Greg Erickson, he's with Free Press International out of Texas. I've interviewed him on one of my past shows. On the first letter, Greg states, "Can you please give us answers to these questions? One, why the picture of a military man killing a white dove? Two, why the Freemason symbol in the New World on the capstone? Three, what are the translations of the writings on the floors at Denver Airport? And four, are there any underground facilities at or around Denver Airport?" Let's see. Okay, the first reply back was October 2003. "Mr. Erickson, we have received both of your emails and we will provide your requested within an appropriate time frame. These questions have been asked ad nauseum by groups like yours throughout the 9-year history of this airport, and quite frankly, they are not our highest priority right now. All of this information has been discussed publicly over and over during the years, and you can select whatever explanation you choose to believe. I have asked our art director to find biographical information about the artist who painted the piece you questioned. She can also provide a fact sheet on the piece itself. She will also provide some fact sheets about the artwork and the floor. As for the New World designation, the New World Airport Commission was simply a group consisting of local business and political leaders who sponsored and organized a number of pre-opening events at Denver Airport. The airport was to usher in a new era, making Denver a world-class city, thus the New World name. The group has absolutely no association with the New World Order. And the underground facilities are just baggage tunnels that are used every day by hundreds of airline workers to take luggage to and from the terminal. However, these explanations rarely satisfy people who love to believe in conspiracy theories and who are convinced that Denver International Airport is at the center of something sinister. It's important to keep in mind that this airport was the largest, most scrutinized public works project in American history. There were cameras and reporters here documenting every single inch of dirt ever removed. If something strange was going on out here, hundreds of media outlets would have been all over it by now. I'm surprised it took you 9 years to send this email. I will get back to you with the information you requested so that you may post it to your website. Of course, I'm betting you will probably post this as well. That was by Steve Snyder, Public Affairs Office at the Denver Airport. Now, Mr. Greg Erickson sent a reply back to Mr. Snyder on October 16th of 2003. "Mr. Snyder, your job as a public servant is to provide information to the public. You weren't hired to chastise the public. The public has a right to know the questions I am asking. So if you would just answer all the questions, I'm sure the public would appreciate it. Greg Erickson." And here's the follow-up email back from the Public Affairs Office. "Mr. Erickson, here is the rest of the information you requested on the artwork at Denver Airport. The artist in question is named Leo Tanguma." I believe that's how you pronounce it. "I don't have any contact information for him, but you might be able to track him down if you have any further questions about his art below or descriptions of his murals at the Denver Airport." And it goes on and on to explain the various murals and what they mean. Okay, this is a second letter received back from the Denver Airport, October 20th. "I receive dozens of requests for information each day. My job is to prioritize these requests in order of importance and respond accordingly. I did not refuse your request for information. I merely told you that it was not a high priority, particularly when I received your second email only 3 days after your first. I base priorities on a number of issues. First and foremost, your questions have literally been discussed hundreds of times during the short history of this airport, and there is plenty of information available on the subject from a variety of sources. Second, this is not of widespread interest to the general public. Oh, really? This is not of widespread interest to the general public. Rather, it is only a few groups who keep raising the topic. Finally, while the artwork in question can certainly require an explanation, you lose credibility in a hurry when you start asking questions about underground facilities at Denver Airport. Hundreds of people work in those baggage tunnels every day, and thousands more have been down there for various reasons over the years. Nobody has ever reported anything remotely suspicious. We've heard all the stories that we're secretly hiding everything from underground runways to slave labor camps down there, and those charges are so far off base, it is almost humorous. And it most certainly is my job to protect the public from misinformation and to chastise those who spread it. Your questions about Denver Airport fall right along the tired old story that this airport is somehow at the center of some giant conspiracy. A quick visit to your website confirmed the underlying nature of your questions. The information we provide never seems to be enough to satisfy people like you, so we all end up wasting our time rehashing ridiculous rumors that simply aren't true. You now have the information you requested, and it was provided to you in a timely manner. You can do with it what you wish. We consider this matter closed. That's by Steve Snyder, again, Public Affairs Office at the Denver Airport. Now, folks, what was I going to say? Forgot. No, yeah, this is what I wanted to point out, folks. Maybe all this stuff was built underground before they even opened the airport. So maybe, you know, all these folks that worked there, they would never come across any of this stuff. Even Phil Schneider, who was murdered back in January 1996, who helped partake in the construction of some of these underground facilities, claimed that they started working on this stuff back in the 40s, so who knows how long it's really been underneath the airport. All right, now this is Greg Erickson replying back to Mr. Snyder, October 20th, 2003. Mr. Snyder, you have stated that you have answered all our questions. This is not true. I would think that it's you losing your credibility. What about the Freemason symbol on the capstone? What about translations of all the writings on the floors of Denver Airport? What does DZITDITGEAII mean? Some type of acronym that's embedded on the floor there at the airport. Okay, and then we get a reply back again from the Public Affairs Office at the airport. Forgive me for assuming you grasped the obvious. The Freemason symbol is on the capstone because they constructed the capstone. And interestingly enough, that acronym I just mentioned, folks, translated means Free Press International bringing you the real world news. Who knew? So, that's actually Greg Erickson's website, by the way. That's pretty interesting. Okay, and then Greg Erickson fires back again to Steve Snyder at the airport, October 21st. Mr. Snyder, you've already been caught in a lie by telling us you answered all our questions, and now you're refusing to translate the writings that are all over the airport. The public has a right to know what these writings mean. We expect full translations from you. We also need the names of the people on the New World Order Commission. Denver Airport has no contact information for the artists who painted the murals. What a laugh. Let's see, and okay, and then Greg Erickson again, our hero here. November 15th of that year, about, almost a month later. Mr. Snyder, it's quite apparent that you have only fueled the conspiracy about the Denver airport. You have refused to provide translations for the coded messages at the airport. You also have not provided the names of the people on the New World Airport Commission. Another question for you is, why is a secretive organization like the Freemasons on the capstone? After talking with Mr. Snyder, it's very clear to me that the Denver airport is hiding something. Now, folks, they got this gargoyle coming out of a suitcase there, and at the bottom is engraved on the bottom of the suitcase, Samsonite. Well, according to Lucas, he's another character out there exposing a lot of this stuff. He says that that's an anagram for Site of the Masons. That pretty much sums that up. I hope you folks found that interesting. Wanted to bring up a few more things here before the show ends, which is getting pretty close already, believe it or not. Boy, that hour has really gone fast. I did want to point out that there was an earthquake in New Mexico. Oh, maybe about a week or so ago. I forgot to print that information out. But there was also an earthquake in Maine, and that was around a 3. Well, in actuality, that would have been a 4. Because whatever they're reporting the public is one full number value less than what it actually is, because they downgraded the Richter scale back in the late 1980s because the powers to be knew that these seismic events would be increasing in the future. Oh, by the way, folks, if you want to learn more about that impending FEMA document that John Moore is about to post on his website, you could go over to gcnlive.com and download the archive from the Nutro Medical Report yesterday, because John Moore was a guest on that show. I haven't posted it on my site yet. I've been pretty busy. Let's see what else we have here. Oh, yeah, about the earthquake in New Mexico, I have some specificities on that for you. I got this off the USGS website. A light earthquake occurred at 7:04 p.m. Central Time on Saturday, March 27th. The magnitude 4.1 event, which is actually 5.1, folks, occurred 18 miles west northwest of Carlsbad, New Mexico. The hypocentral depth is 3 miles. I privately talked to John Moore about this, and me and him, we don't even know if that's normal for that area in New Mexico to have earthquakes. But so there you go. That's what happened there in New Mexico. Then I got this little article I printed up about the earthquake that rumbled parts of Maine, dated March 31st. That would have been about, what, 3 or 4 days ago. A minor earthquake occurred yesterday 10 miles south of Bangor, Maine, rated at magnitude 3.0, which is actually 4.0, folks, according to the USGS. Most earthquakes occur along active fault lines. However, we do not live near an active fault line. Well, that's interesting. What we do know is that Maine lies on the North American tectonic plate, and the nearest fault line lies well offshore by several hundreds of miles in the Atlantic Ocean. Furthermore, not much is still understood about seismic activity in the Northeast because it is a fairly inactive region. Despite the rumblings so close to Bangor, the city itself did not shake because of a layer of granite that lies underneath the ground. The granite helped to absorb the shock. So the only areas that felt the earth move was right around the immediate epicenter. Quakes happen all the time, but the most activity does lie along fault lines, such as the San Andreas Fault near California. There's a little synopsis on that for you folks. Now, I did want to play another soundbite for you here just to see how this all works out on my end. This was one of the NPR, National Public Radio, put this out back in December of last year. The article's entitled "Spying on Icebergs Instead of Terrorists?" Obama program diverts intelligence assets to climate research. I'm going to play this little soundbite off NPR so you can hear what NPR had to report about this, the CIA spying on icebergs instead of terrorists. Kind of interesting. By the way, keep in mind the CIA's out in Denver now.
Within the U.S. government, climate change is not just the concern of White House and environmental officials. The Pentagon will soon list global warming among the security threats facing the United States. Of course, the national security agenda is pretty full these days, so climate change has to compete for attention. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
Security experts who focus on climate change don't bother evaluating the scientific claims about global warming. If there's even a chance the projections are accurate, they want to be prepared. I always look at the worst case, says one senior intelligence official who follows climate issues. Whether it's global warming or the chance of country A invading country B, I just assume the most likely outcome is the worst one. That's the intelligence view. And military leaders prepare for contingencies.
The American people expect the military to plan for the worst.
Retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn is president of the American Security Project.
So it's that sort of mindset, I think, that has convinced, in my view, the vast majority of military leaders that climate change is a real threat and that the military plays an important role in confronting it.
Here's a case, the melting of the massive Himalayan glaciers. In theory, the rivers fed by the glaciers would flood at first, then dry up once the glaciers retreat. That would endanger tens of millions of people down below around Bangladesh. Retired Air Marshal A.K. Singh, a former commander of the Indian Air Force, foresees mass migrations across national borders, with militaries soon becoming involved.
You see, it will initially start with people fighting for food and shelter. When the migration starts, every state would want to stop the migrations from happening. Eventually, it would have to become a military conflict. Which other means do you have to resolve your border issues?
Such are the scenarios that make climate change a security concern. Migrations, humanitarian emergencies, food and water shortages, violent conflicts over resources. The next Quadrennial Defense Review, an official once every 4 years look at Pentagon priorities, will address climate change concerns for the first time ever. Amanda Dory is the Deputy Assistant Secretary overseeing the review process.
The projections lead us to believe that things like severe weather events will increase in intensity in the future, perhaps in frequency as well.
And that means Defense Department planners figure civilian agencies will be looking for more military help to deal with natural disasters. Retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn makes another point. Ship and aircraft designers need to consider the climate of the future.
When you talk about building ships that are going to last from 30 to 50 years, or programming for Air Force and Navy and Marine Corps aircraft that are not going to be put in the air for 20 years, you have to be thinking about the kinds of changed conditions into which you're going to throw them in the future.
Still, there's only so much military planners can do to prepare for the consequences of climate change. The Quadrennial Defense Review, due to be delivered in February, will say what climate change would mean for the Defense Department's roles, missions, and installations. New responsibilities, new equipment, new bases? Not necessarily, says the Pentagon's Amanda Dury.
We don't anticipate that there are new mission areas as a result of climate change. Similarly, there may be changes in technical specifications for platforms, but not the need for new types of platforms that we don't already possess.
In Pentagon jargon, platforms are the things in which weapons are carried, like ships or aircraft. Actually, climate change right now may be a more important subject for intelligence analysts than for military planners. The CIA's new Center for the Study of Climate Change is trying to develop a set of early warning signs that could suggest where the next famine might arise or which countries are in most danger of being destabilized as a result of dramatic climate changes. Intelligence officials actually put those countries on a stability watch list. How far to go with these climate and security projections, however, is a matter of dispute. It's hard enough to figure out what will happen next year, let alone 30 years from now.
We suck at predicting wars. We're not very good at predicting peace.
Now, folks, I just wanted to interject here by stating that, they're projecting this stuff to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years out. This is part of the psyops designed to lead people astray so they'll never figure out in time what's about to hit them. But anyway, thought I'd play that for what it's worth. We got about 4 minutes left on the show here. There was a little bit left on that soundbite, but I'm going to end it because we're getting so close to the end of the show. But I also have this dot connector with what I just played off NPR back on March 22nd. There was an article put out on the Scotsman, and this is on Stan Deo's website, by the way. It's entitled Drought, Refugees, Revolution, and War, Military Prepares for Climate Doomsday. And it says military chiefs are holding backroom discussions on how to cope with the threat of a world ravaged by wars provoked by uncontrolled climate change, an expert has warned. Tens of millions of climate refugees unable to feed themselves in their own dried-up countries will aim for places like Scotland where conditions will remain favorable. These countries will in turn use their military powers to barricade their borders, leading to wars over land, food, and water. So that goes on and on. I got one more thing, one more soundbite here on the MP3 player I wanted to play for you folks. This was John DiNardo. He spoke about these scorching solar storms that could be headed our way as a result of the passage of Planet X. But so I'll just this is from John Moore's show about I think it was about 3 weeks ago. So just let me. Here we go.
I'd like to mention that I think we should begin to warn our audience that they should start really thinking about and working together with us in preparing for solar storms that I suspect and many other people suspect are going to be occurring this year or next year. Solar storms that could be so severe that two major catastrophes will result. One would be the destruction of our power grids, and that would throw us back into a primitive lifestyle. We would be overnight forced into, ancient ways of living.
Here's what people understand, the power grid as we know it, really only existed since World War II. The power grid, it was in the cities first and didn't expand out past the cities until the 1940s. But the infrastructure that people had in the teens and 20s and 30s on these farms and ranches, that's all gone. So we'd be going back to no electricity without the infrastructure that was the infrastructure we had in the teens, 20s and 30s on these farms and ranches was not too bad, but that's all gone.
That's right. So we have to start talking about preparing. We've really put out, and we've got a lot of evidence to indicate that these solar storms are coming soon. We could talk about Planet X and how it is exciting the sun and beginning to excite the sun after its this 2-year lull in solar activity, which I believe was due to Planet X passing below Jupiter and Planet X and its hordes of surrounding comets interacting electrically with Jupiter, drawing electrical fire away from the sun and toward Jupiter, but that was just a temporary lull before the storm. Now we can expect solar blasting, and there's a great deal of evidence I'd like to touch on quickly.
That's the end of the show, folks. We'll be back next week. Hey, go buy yourself a boat. You want solutions? Well, all we can really do is prepare and maybe buy a boat. We'll be back next week. Later.
This is Micro 1650 AM, a 100 milliwatt Part 15 broadcaster. No matter what your political ideology, it should be clear that the mainstream media simply doesn't give you the whole story. These days, if you want the truth, you have to know where to find it. Well, you found it right here on Micro 1650 AM. We've partnered with some of the best alternative news sources in the business: RBN, the IRN USA Network, Oracle Broadcasting, Liberty News Radio, Accent Radio, and The Micro Effect. These networks offer intelligent, informative, and thought-provoking programming that will open your eyes to what's really going on. Your comments and questions about the programming are always welcome. Contact us at micro1650am@gmail.com. That's micro1650am@gmail.com. You can listen online and find out more about us at micro1650am.com. Enjoy the show. We have more listeners than the Big Boys HD2 channels. This is Micro 1650 AM, Tonawanda, New York.